Dear DCI Collier, thank you for your considerate message. My wife Susan and I would be delighted to assist you in any way we can and to put this whole matter behind us once and for all.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 384 for the week of December 6th, 2021. I am Mint Collectible David T. Cole, and I'm here with Deep Hole Sarah D. Bunting.
No comment.
And Gerard Depardieu fan Tara Ariano.
Zoot alor. Welcome to Extra Hot Grape for another week. Thank you all so very much for joining us. First, a little podcast business. We are supposed to have been joined today by Brandy Brown. Sadly, she is not able to join us tonight, so we are going to proceed without her and have her back as soon as we can in the new year. We're here to talk about Landscapers on HBO, and I can't really improve upon the text that opens the first episode of this British true crime story. In 2014, Susan and Christopher Edwards were convicted of murder and sentenced to a minimum of 25 years. They have maintained their innocence to this day. And over the course of the first episode, those of us who didn't already know the case from the news learn whom they were convicted of murdering, but the reasons why they may have done it are revealed over subsequent installments of the four-episode series. As it goes on, we also see more unusual, impressionistic, fourth-wall-breaking style choices in the filmmaking. Olivia Colman and David Thewlis play Susan and Christopher. The series was created and written by Ed Sinclair, who happens to be Colman's husband. He doesn't have a ton of other credits on IMDb, so I assumed he was a playwright, but the internet does not seem to know that. And it was directed by Will Sharp, who previously wrote and directed the half-hour series Flowers, which we tried to watch when it was on CISO, RIP. It did not take. We watched one episode, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Only one episode of Landscapers has aired so far. We'll be talking about that one in detail. Some of us have watched the whole series, may refer to contents for future episodes, but we'll try to be careful about plot points. Chen check in. Sarah, sure listeners, watch Landscapers.
Yes.
David T. Cole.
I feel like it tries too hard at sometimes, but it's still worth a watch.
I enjoyed watching it, but yes, some of it did seem a little bit labored in a way that was perhaps padding it out a touch.
Yeah, agree.
Let me lead into that with a question that I think is probably mostly for Sarah, who is our true crime expert. The framing of this, there's a lot of sort of unconventional framing and set dressing and
fantasy sequences.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In this, do you think this is like an early indicator of true crime saturation?
Or
is it just like that's a bottomless pit that will never be filled because people's appetite for it is just too strong?
So you're asking, are these sort of efforts to set themselves apart a sign that we've reached a saturation point in the market?
Yeah, partly that. And I think now that you've said that, the other part of the question is this particular case kind of generic, so they feel like they have to sort of dress it up a bit? Because the nutshell is they probably killed her parents for welfare money.
Yeah, for his pension, her parents' pension.
Mm-hmm. And for, you know, and for revenge and for a number of other reasons. But to take the first part of your question first, I don't think so, because there are a lot of different kinds and classes of televised true crime that I think that there will never be a saturation point for the kind of consumer who watches Oxygen, like Wives with Knives, Buried in My Backyard, shit like that, for what we would call prestige true crime, such as this, with them accents and costumes and whatnot. Because I have to consume a lot of stuff like this, I appreciate attempts to look at the story of the story a little bit more in this way. Is this over-directed? Absolutely. did I appreciate different things that they did just to get away from, like, let's show B-roll of a fucking cassette recorder rolling while this, you know, police officer, like, instead, they put the police officer into a flashback scene, read an email. You can see set elements a lot of the time, like from the very beginning, you're outside of that frame looking at the making of this thing. And did it get a little tricksy with some of the stuff where, like, they were transplanted into a Western? Like, it's a lot. But at least they're trying to do something different and trying to get at the real, what boils down to a, like, they said story. Mm-hmm. In the end, they're trying to get at something else besides a prurient recitation of fact. Was this a lot of, like, this is not victim-centering, I'll say that. But a more impressionistic take like this, or an attempt like Bart Layton did with American Animals to try to hybridize the format a little bit, I welcome it. Will this also be something that we get sick of? Or, like, we're like, what a cliche, a drone shot of a water tower. Yeah. Maybe, but we're not there yet. And there were aspects of both these performances that I thought were very compelling. But yes, over tricksy at points and too long. I think it could have been done in three.
I agree. This sort of thing is not usually your jam, but we did end up watching the whole thing. So what aspects of that first episode particularly made you want to keep watching?
Honestly, the first episode I wasn't that hot on. And what actually kept me going is trying to figure out what the hell they were doing with their presentation of time. Mm-hmm. Because the opening mostly takes place in their French apartment. But this French apartment looks like it could be anywhere from the 30s all the way up to the 70s.
Yeah,
it looked like a Call the Midwife set.
Yes,
and then
it did.
The way they're dressed, I was like, is this Call the Midwife outtakes? Like, when are we? Yeah.
Exactly. When are we? And I understand that's the stylistic choice. It sort of puts you in a frame of mind of, like, what is reliable, what is actually happening. It's just sort of like, you know, just putting you on notice, I guess. But it really felt like watching an episode of The Prisoner. It had exactly the same sort of, what exactly is going on? Where are they? When are they? Mm-hmm. And it had this, had the same sort of vibe to it. So it interests me in that way. I feel like they calmed down that part of the presentation as the story goes on. There's certainly more period notes and technology and stuff like that that they hint. But overall, like, the presentation at once tricksy, but it's also like it is set, like, it could be one of, like, six decades. And it was just very interesting. And I kind of felt foggy watching the first episode, you know, because of all these ways that they presented it. Why I was asking about the whole, like, is this saturation? Because I feel like they took a case that was big in the news, but when you compare it to all the things that have happened in true crime since and all the, like, weird stories that true crime as a genre has dealt with, like, this is kind of, like, not that big of a case or like special of a case.
Well, it sort of feels like a cozy mystery in a way too. I mean, real people are involved, but it's, there's, you know, they buried them in the garden. Like, it's there's something sort of, like, quaint about it, other than until you start getting further into the series and getting, like, all the truly gnarly details.
Yeah. And some of it is gnarly, but then some of it, as you said, Dave, is sort of like, not quotidian exactly, but maybe this case was picked because there are opportunities to look at the meta, more meta things, like the unreliability of memory, the way that the public will seize on certain details, like the Depardieu correspondence that's like, you know, like that there's movie memorabilia involved, I think makes it like that sort of catnip to the headline writing and consuming public.
Yep. Well, and the miniseries writer too, obviously.
I mean, I was actually a little surprised that the man himself did not appear at the end. Or maybe he does. Spoiler, he doesn't. but yeah, it's There's a lot of ways in which the case is, like, it has unique specificities, but it's also like at the heart of it is a mystery that we're never really going to know what happened, and no one's ever really going to be able to tell us what happened. And that's one of the things that I think is like the poppy seed in the mental gum line of true crime consumers, that it's like the unknowability is attractive and repellent. So
right.
The other part that I enjoyed was just seeing polite British people doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very sort of yes, dear kind of vibe to this. I mean, not the show, but just like that sort of like, yes, dear. Mm-hmm, yes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that you would imagine living in the same house for 60 years, gardening 2 hours on a Sunday together in the backyard. Like, is that kind of British couple? Except, you know, they're doing all these terrible things. And that part of it was also interesting to me. Like, I felt like that was a little bit different from stuff I've been watching. Like, you know, when you watch like Making a Murderer, it's like, well, these are bad people doing bad things. I mean, this one was like, these are weirdly polite people that are exercising their like worst intentions, but still in that prim and proper British way. That was very compelling. So,
yeah.
it was the off-kilter weirdness of the series that kept me watching. Like at the end of the series, when all is done and said about the crime, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's pretty much what we figured going into it. Spoiler, I mean,
they tell you how it ends from the beginning.
All right. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that they did it, but whatever.
Yes.
What I'm saying is it didn't have twists and turns like some true crime things have, where you're like, they set up the narrative so you think it's person A, and then suddenly, no, it's person B that they sort of pick up on the storyline, you know, halfway into the series. Like it's not that sort of true crime narrative. It's really, here is this pretty straight, understandable crime that they were both in on, and how can we tell it in a different compelling way? And that different compelling way is what made me stick around, even though I felt at times, especially when we got to the end of the series, it was like, okay, this is too much. He needed to like pull it back a bit.
Take one thing off.
Yeah, but it was still good. Yeah. Olivia Colman's great. David was great. It was really weird to hear him talk after watching so much Big Mouth, because that is he's the shame
wizard.
He's not doing a voice. He's just him. Mm-hmm. So it is exactly his voice. And I couldn't, like, I was just imagining him as the shame wizard at times.
How did we feel about the cops and like the sort of, not slapstick, but just it was very different tonally, and immediately there's just like a ton of swearing and this, you know, DCI being like, please stop telling me to fuck off, sir. I mean, I enjoyed it, but that's not always a tone that you get, at least in an American docudrama where everyone would be exceedingly careful not to seem too snarky. How did we feel about that? Too much?
I felt like that part of it was like picked up from a scripted show and plopped in. Like if you just took those scenes and stuck them all together and had somebody watch it, you could believe that was like some, you know, maybe not Luther, but something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't mind it. Again, it was just one other thing on the board that was like, well, what is going on here exactly? Like there's a scene after the first episode where they have a breakthrough and they all just like start cheering like they...
That was great.
Like their football team just scored a goal in the last minute. And that was just like, what? You know? And it was like, it was a fun little moment. And it was just very, again, you're wondering where your footing is after things like that. And it was fun.
Yeah. There's a forensic accountant who is so smug. Or actually, she's not even smug.
No, she was cute. She was excited to
joy
be helpful.
That she was like, it's like, I don't follow. She's like, you don't have to. It's all right there in this report that I've prepared. And then she's just beaming at having cracked it. It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, I think I always like to watch, you know, scripted or, I mean, this was obviously scripted too, but fictional or non-fictional versions of British interrogation, because they do have like an explicitly different approach than certainly at least what we see in scripted American crime shows.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's more of an effort to get the person on side, build rapport, like all the things that we're told is going to actually lead to effective disclosure.
Yeah, there's a tone in the British interrogations that would tonally, believably lead you to can I offer you a cuppa? Where mm-hmm. in the British, or in the American ones, you would never actually get to that point. Like right. there is not that rapport
yes.
where you feel like you could actually yeah. offer somebody a cup of tea and make it believable. But yes. in this British show, if they said, would you want a cup of Earl Grey? And you said yes, I'd be like, yep, that definitely happens there. I totally believe it.
Yeah. yeah. Whereas in like a Law and Order, and this is actually something that they did, they just give you cuppa after cuppa and won't let you pee.
Yes.
And finally you'll say anything.
Right.
Just to go to the bathroom.
Right. right. Or it's to steal your DNA because you mm-hmm. weren't given the sample, so they want to take it off your glass, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
So the first episode also brings us those detectives discussing the old metaphor about relationships, you know, consisting of a garden and a gardener. And in light of, you know, Christopher's go-to description of Susan is fragile and, you know, in light of also what they planted in that one particular garden, was that too on the nose for you or did it work?
No, it worked because, you know, I think that I think so much of this story, the story's engine is this particular folie à scone that, that they're engaged in or, mm-hmm. Amour fool, you know, I don't know what exactly
Amour
you would
weird.
Call it. yeah. Amour, huh? But I think that that's, no, I didn't think that was too on the nose. Like there were things that sort of like symbological systems in this that I was like, got it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was impressed at how much money was spent on some of these.
Yeah.
I had no problem with that. And like that they took the time to have like a weirdo neighbor during that first visit to the property
yes.
where he's just like in this hole in the hedge. And then the other neighbor's like, so I've noticed that you've been barbecuing kind of a lot, Nige. And then you get a shot of like the barbecue, like beef smoke pouring onto the property. And it's like,
yeah,
there's no reason for this, but I appreciated the detail. Like mm-hmm. I live in a row house. If someone's cooking chicken, you all have to live with it. So
I'm kind of fascinated that they were able to stay on the lam for 15 years. I mean, granted, partly because no one knew there was any reason to pursue them, but still, that's a long time.
Also, went to 1952, where no one thought to look for them, as Dave pointed out.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a long time to make relatively limited resources, like stretch, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, their place looked shitty, but I'm sure it was still expensive. It was in France.
Yeah. Well, and it was furnished with all mid-century furniture that actually cost a fortune. Like, mm-hmm. did either of you wish they'd gotten a little more into her, like, memorabilia hoarding problem? I guess once you've sort of nodded at it, you don't really have to get into it, but we'll have a link in the show notes.
I was more interested in the catch me if you can-esque document forgery, not the forgery stuff, but there's like a scene later on where she goes through how she's sending letters. I'll just leave mm-hmm. it at that.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. the thing she does to make that believable. And I was like, what the hell?
Yeah. I laughed out loud at that. Like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. What, the mind it would take to like have the hardware required.
Right.
To
yeah. do it. I mean, that was sort of fascinating. So yeah, those little touches where you get more into the mind of
processy.
Them, mm-hmm. Yeah. But like outside of, you know, killing people, right?
Right.
you know, this is all about maintaining. Actually, that was even really part of the crime, the stuff we're talking
no,
about with
that
letters.
No, that was just a weird, another
yeah,
weird
it was just
quirk.
Weird. But just sort of like their lives outside of actually committing this crime mm-hmm. had all these little hints of weird little quirky things. Mm-hmm. And I'm hesitant to say I wanted more of it because often when you want more of those little things, suddenly it's like, oh, it's too sweet. But mm-hmm. What I got, I enjoyed. I'll say that much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coleman, I think, is definitely going to get an Emmy nomination because she's an Oscar
oh,
winner
yeah.
and that's how the Emmys work. But mm-hmm. I feel like this is the kind of performance she can give in her sleep. And when I was trying to figure out what her husband's like professional deal was, I saw that they were at Cambridge together at the same time with Peter Serafinowicz, David Mitchell, and Robert Webb, which like makes me wish.
Wow.
Go back to comedy. Like she's so funny. And I feel like she's the prestige roles mean like, I mean, she's funny in this too, but it's not a comedy role.
Well, she split the difference in the favorite, right? I mean, she was sort of goofy in there.
Yeah, I just kept thinking also of, like, whenever I see her in an interrogation room in any setting now, I'm thinking of her realizing what was actually going on in Broadchurch and lurching into the corner to just barf herself inside out to death.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe these, like, pitiable roles, like, okay, you've gotten what you needed from this.
Yeah.
maybe go back to funny stuff.
Yeah. Or do a Melissa McCarthy where it's like, we know you can make yourself look like a goofy weirdo. Mm-hmm. Like, do something where you're glam. just to change it up, because you can do that too. I mean, the Queen, obviously, I guess that was pretty glam, but also pretty dowdy. Was Thewlis on her level? David already talked about her. Did you think that he was a good scene partner for her, Sarah?
Yeah. I haven't seen all of the stuff he's done, but this is someone who is like just very confident, I think, in whatever he's asked to do.
Yeah.
So that's a good, you also don't want someone who's known for being hot.
Right.
Necessarily. Like, he does have that jolie laid thing, I think. But
yeah,
I think that you need a certain confidence, especially in a role like this, where you have two sort of fragile, broken people cohabiting, not just on the screen, but like in, you know, as characters. So I think that you need an actor who's just going to do what he's asked to do and not be trying to be too big and not fight her.
Yeah.
And he was really good in that, and looked mysteriously foxy in the Western wear, if you're
yeah, it's true.
A Thewlisian, something to look forward to besides dowdy cardigans.
Indeed. I'll also add, before we wrap it up, for people who are interested in true crime miniseries about British people who are unwavering in claiming their innocence, I talked about it at the time that it came out, but Quiz is a 3-part miniseries about a couple that may or may not have cheated on the British Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And that one is much more straight ahead in its storytelling and in style than this, but also a great story with a lot of compelling figures. And we'll link in the show notes where you can track that down, because it's not still streaming for free, hardly anywhere, I think.
Yeah, it's good. Matthew McFadden from Succession.
It is time to go around the dial for Septar.
The back half of Money Heist's final season dropped last Friday. I talked about it in the fall when the first half dropped, and I'm sure I complained that the second heist was half again as long as the last one was, and you definitely feel it. There's really a lot of downtime where people are like having sex or having a bath, literally having a bath. And there were many points where I'd have to be like, wait, are there even still hostages inside anymore? Because there would be lots of episodes where we don't see them. And they definitely were more central to the plot in the first half. But that said, as much as I felt like the season was excessively padded, it did have a good ending. I didn't see it coming. I won't get into the weeds of the heist story because the episodes only dropped a few days ago. But there are a few plot threads that were handled so badly that they took me out of it. And if you really don't want to be spoiled, come back in a minute. Spoilers ho, fun ahoy. So one revolves around Denver, Stockholm, and Manila. Manila was Denver's best friend when they were kids and has since then transitioned. And in the first half of the season, Manila confessed her love to Denver. And mostly away from them, Stockholm was having severe PTSD symptoms, including hallucinations, after killing someone in the heist. And in the mid-season finale, she had taken a dose of morphine, you know, to make the feelings go away. So with Manila and Denver, he also seems like he's into her and they kiss, but then she just tells Lisbon in Stockholm that when they kissed, she felt nothing. So everything's fine for her and she can move on. It's a Pat TV solution, A. B, she never actually says that to him, but it's enough of an issue for Denver that he confesses to Stockholm that they kissed and says he was sometimes bored by his life in Indonesia with Stockholm and would sneak off to go clubbing and feel bad about it. And this seems to be mostly what he thinks he might regain if he were to leave Stockholm for Manila, because clubbing was a big part of their former friendship. And then Stockholm has an auditory hallucination a few hours after this and starts wildly shooting. And Denver's like, we're going to go close ourselves up in the vault so you don't kill anyone else, which, handling a wife's mental illness by locking her in a smaller room in the place where you're living, very Victorian solution. She's also been given antipsychotics by a surgeon who has come in to treat someone. We never see her actually take those drugs, so that's like another plot drop thread. But in the vault, Stockholm's like, it's fine. I knew about the clubbing. I didn't want to ask you and have you confirm that our son and I were not enough for you, but I would love to see you dance like you do. And he's like, I want to see you dance. And she's like, I'm gross and I still have blood on me. So he goes and finds a tuxedo somewhere. I guess it's supposed to be like the governor of the banks, but it is perfectly tailored to this very tall, slim woman, just not at all a men's suit. And then she strips of him, they have sex, he recommits to her, and then she's totally fine after that mentally. Not how mental illness works.
Magic her- D.
Yeah.
Sure.
Solving her problems by having him fuck them out of her is terrible.
Yeah, no, that's bullshit.
The other bad story involves Sierra, who is the cop who tortured Rio. And the short version is they give her a redemption arc that includes her switching to the gang side. They notably never show her and Rio together, probably hoping that we don't remember how she is even involved in this story because it was pretty bad. I hate it. That's the end of the spoilers. So now Money Heist is over, but there's a prequel spinoff coming that revolves around Berlin. And speaking of things the producers hope we forget, it's established in the first couple of seasons that he is a rapist. So this might also be a redemption retcon for him. I'm going to go ahead and skip it.
Yeah, nobody was asking for a Berlin spinoff.
No. There's a bunch of flashbacks to him in this season that are like, okay, he does cool shit, but like, he's a bad person. I don't want to watch a whole show about him. Annie Live. When the movie version of Annie came out, I was 7. So
there
basically,
is no segue.
No.
Here's the segue.
I didn't bother.
Speaking about people getting orphaned.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, my neck.
When the movie version came out, I was 7. I was the exact right age for it to imprint on me. Mm-hmm. I had toys. I had the novelization. When we visited my grandparents in Winnipeg, I would try and make myself care about the comic strip, which was still running in the Winnipeg Free Press at that time.
Yeah.
Impossible because it was super boring. But anyway, yeah. Like Smash, Annie is an empirically bad musical that I nevertheless love. I also had the Broadway album as a child. I'm going to say watching Same. This made me realize Side 2 basically never got played at my house because the show is real lopsided. I was discussing this with our friend Adam Grossworth the night it aired. His view is that opening the show with Maybe is child abuse because it's impossible for a kid to sing it without sounding whiny. True. Mm. And it's our introduction to the character. But then in rapid succession, you kind of get all the bangers right away. Hard Knock Life, Tomorrow, Little Girls, I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here, NYC. It is truly wild that the Act One closer isn't Tomorrow. It's You Won't Be an Orphan for Long. Like, who even remembers that? But anyway.
Yeah.
I'm not here to criticize the actual show, I guess, particularly since it's, you know, built on good socialist values and we love to see it. But the live version that NBC aired last week and the titular role is played by Selena Smith, who I think is better at the acting and was maybe nervous with the singing. She's a little pitchy. It's clear she can do it, but she did not quite hit every note. Taraji P. Henson as Miss Hannigan was very good casting on paper, but as Catherine Van Arendonk and Jackson McHenry noted at Vulture in their review, which we'll link in the show notes, this Miss Hannigan is more silly than, like, a scary alcoholic, which is what the part actually is. Her best moments were with Titus Burgess as her brother Rooster, the con artist, and Rooster's girlfriend Lily St. Regis, played by Megan Hilty in a last-minute change after Jane Krakowski got COVID. I would have liked to see Burgess and Krakowski together after all their years on Kimmy Schmidt, but obviously Hilty is a total pro. I'm sure she came to the set off book because, you know, kind of a well-known show.
Yeah.
And I was prepared to be annoyed by Harry Connick Jr.'s Daddy Warbucks, but he kind of did it for me. Like, he's corny, but he is a very good singer, and they wrote it into this version that Daddy Warbucks plays the piano sometimes, which was fun and cute. And our old friend Alan Toy from 90210 was good in the relatively small role of FDR. I felt weirdly proud of him the way I do whenever a bit player from 90210 does something cool.
I know, same. It's like whenever I see the Chancellor in Airplane, I'm like,
yes,
buddy!
Totally.
You never vomited on 90210.
As Miss Farrell, Nicole Scherzinger is very pretty. That's me. And she can sing and dance. I would not call her a triple threat acting-wise. And I also learned from the Vulture post that Macy, who played Sandy the dog, was rescued from a shelter in Oklahoma and has played the role more than any other dog in the show's history, although the post they linked to doesn't say how many that is. It could be 3. Who knows? But still, good job, Macy. And there are some goofy moments that were added to make even more obvious the connections between the depression the characters are enduring and our own moment 2021-wise, but When Daddy Warbucks gets a line about how happy he is that Broadway's getting back on its feet after hard times, even though it's pure pandering for the audience that was self-select to watch this either in the studio or at home, that still worked on me also. And there's a lot of flab in the show, but if your tolerance for adorable Muppets singing loud is not so low that you stopped listening when I started talking about this, it's not an unpleasant sit. And they also do a cute thing where, like, some of the throws to the ads are, like, in the style of the toothpaste ad in the show, like with jingles with the, you know, close harmony singing by lady pitch women, which is cute.
And it's very cute.
So for my plug, speaking of Money Heist, I recapped every one of those five episodes in 2 days. You can find those at Vulture. And since I talked about it the last time we were here, the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show hit its stretch goals. So there will be those three Zoom Game Shelf decathlons in the week between Christmas and New Year's. That'll be on the 26th, 28th, and 30th, with each of the principals up from that podcast hosting one of the three.
Yeah, 26th will be mine. It will be a sort of trivia list. One is going to be mostly group party games than like straight pop culture trivia kind of stuff. So if you kind of want to get, if you enjoy things like playing celebrity and that kind of stuff, more in that vein, that's going to be probably the thrust of mine. So
love it.
Sarah D. Bunting.
In keeping with what is apparently the theme of dark European content, Baptiste. It was actually back earlier this year, but I'd forgot the show's existence and then was like leafing through the PBS app as I do, befitting my status as an 85-year-old grandfather. This is the spinoff of Starz's Undersung The Missing, which stars the great Checky Cargiu as the titular missing persons freelance detective Julien Baptiste. This is the second and final series in the spinoff, and as much as I have liked the show and the character, that is a good thing. The second series does have a lot to recommend it. Chief among those things, the also great Fiona Shaw as Baptiste's sort of unwilling client, I guess. She plays Emma Chambers, who is a British ambassador to Hungary, whose husband and sons get kidnapped, or do they? And in the early going, the gradual brushing away of cobwebs to reveal what happened between the inciting incident and the present day, in which Chambers is now using a wheelchair, and Baptiste is sporting the Santa beard of complex grief and regret, is compelling. But despite Cargiu and Shaw having watchable, weirdly resentful partner chemistry in both timelines, and despite these great actors putting over turgid musings on the nature of family and loss that you almost don't notice are not how people talk at all until the end of the scene, the second series is too long by about a third. The flashback and forthing isn't injudicious, but after a certain point, when you have A, put together exactly what went down with the Chambers teens, and B, made all the figurative connections between family bonds and national or geographical identity, you look around and realize there's still 80-odd minutes to go. And how do you fill that time? Spoiler, not with the secondary question of whether the Baptiste marriage can be resurrected. Not terribly suspenseful. Still, it is a pleasure to watch these two pros work. The scenery is forbiddingly lovely. No, Hungary is not a character, but still, it's nice to look at. And I think the character is left in a good place. You can watch that on the PBS app under the aegis of Masterpiece, or you can buy either of the seasons on Apple TV. Speaking of good places and buying stuff, hey. I have a true crime bookshop. It's called Exhibit B, and it is, as we speak, having a 12% off Days of Christmas or whatever other winter holiday sale. Each day, I'm adding another tag to the list of eligible products for the discount. And by entering code EX12 at checkout, you can get 12% off of those products and all the ones that came before it on the list. Gift cards, major case books, stuff tagged as seen on TV, which is quite a bit, actually. It is all 12% off through December 17th. And if you got a true crime fan as part of your office holiday swap and you don't know where to start, an Exhibit B gift card cracks that case in a hurry. Just saying. ExhibitBbooks.com, code EX12 at checkout. Merry happy.
Briefly, because Marvel likes to fumble things at the 5-yard line. Talk about Hawkeye. So far, after 3 episodes, confirmed everything I thought this series was going to be before it started. A, Jeremy Renner is still terrible and is still a charisma vacuum as Hawkeye.
Yes.
B, Haley Stanfield is really good as Kate Bishop and probably, hopefully, will become the new Hawkeye after the end of this and they'll retire Jeremy Renner, knock on wood. And C, the story in the series borrows trappings from the really, really good comic run everybody always talks about with Hawkeye, with Pizza Dog and the Tracksuit Mafia, but really it's not the same story. So there's a sort of like, I feel like trying to steal some goodwill out of that comic book run, but yet not using it.
Right.
We'll see what happens at the end. Like, so far it is fine. Like, it is light and pretty airy for the most part. And it is perfectly cromulent, and we'll just see what happens at the end. I will say this one has more of a likelihood to stick the landing because the stakes are already small to begin with. Like, it's just some dudes having some Christmas fights in New York City. And
some dudes having some Christmas fights. There's worse elevator pitches in the world, just saying.
So really, I just wanted to, because people kind of expect us to talk somewhere about the latest Marvel things and hear Tara complain about them. I just wanted to put it out there that probably best for a bigger wrap up when it ends rather than talk about it after 3 episodes. So if you have any thoughts, Tara, please.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm not going to yell about it because, as I said the last time I talked about it, it's like I've accepted what these things do and I'm not going to let myself get sucked in and care about them again. It's
just
fine.
Their nature. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say, if you watch Hawkeye, you should also watch Dickinson for yourself. It's and for the culture and for Haley Steinfeld, because we caught up last night. We watched 6 episodes back to back. We sort of let it lie fallow, and God, it's so good. She is great in that part, and it's so interesting and smart and not in a self-conscious, like, showy way. It's just good.
Yep.
It's better than Hawkeye.
If Hawkeye is not your thing, please tune in to Extra Extra Hot Great for the 12 shows of Christmas, in which we present to you each 12 shows that might be worth your bingeable time over the holidays. So a maximum total of 36, even though I think we'll probably have some overlap here and there. I understand that Tara has actually compiled a list of like 100 shows. So when we duplicate Tara, she can go to her B list.
That's correct. I have 25 shows.
You're looking for suggestions. Tune into that. That will come out this Friday, available to all supporters at any level. Please visit patreon.com/extrahotgreat to get in on that and support this podcast. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, it is And Just Like That, the Sex and the City sequel series. And we're welcoming back the Fug Girls for that one.
Woo! Woo!
Yay!
Hi, Extra Hot Great. It's Eleanor, and I am submitting for consideration for induction into the canon, Drunk History, Season 5, Episode 5, Civil Rights. As has been said, Drunk History is a very visual show, and so it's sometimes hard to convey what's going on in audio. But you've seen the episode, so I am going to list a few points in favor of Civil Rights' induction into the canon. Point 1. The best episodes of Drunk History have excellent narrators, and this episode exemplifies that. I loved Crystal's Harriet Tubman segment on a certain episode a long time ago, so when I found out she was on another episode, I was like, yes. And this episode has Crystal, in addition to Kirby Hall-Baptiste and Susie Barrett. I'd never seen Susie Barrett in anything, but she's awesome in this, and she made me cry. More on that later. Point 2. This is kind of a heavy episode in that you watch black children sprayed with fire hoses and have dogs unleashed on them, among other things. But it really highlights across all these segments what it takes to fight for things. And if a show that's just an extended bit can make you laugh, but also make you cry and want to beat up the police, well, I think that's just special. 3. Drunk History often goes viral with individual clips of individual stories within episodes, but this episode is a straight banger from start to finish, which is why it deserves induction into the canon. Point 3A. Kirby Howell-Baptiste narrates the story of Emmeline Pankhurst and the British suffragettes learning jujitsu so they can fight the cops who keep trying to arrest them for speaking about the vote. And Kirby is like, the cops are counter-revolutionary. Clip one.
In February 1914, Emmeline delivered a speech in Camden Square. And at the end, she goes, okay, you lot, I'm coming down now. And police, you can try and grab these titties, whatever. She comes downstairs, and then the commissioner goes, grab her by the titties, I say, grab her by the titties. And the other guy goes, whoa, this is my first day. I didn't know we were going to be grabbing people by the titties. And he goes, welcome to the Metropolitan Police.
The montage of the women tossing around the cops is so metal. Point 3B. Crystal narrates the story of the Birmingham Children's March, and hearing Crystal's voice come out of a child is a truly blessed experience. I loved the visuals in this one, and particularly the evergreen newspaper front page headline, which reads, quote, the bullshit that's happening to Black people, end quote. Point 3C. Susie Barrett narrates the story of Judy Heumann and the 504 sit-in, and this is the high point of the episode for me. The segment has a huge cast, including disabled people playing disabled people, Craig Kakowski playing our second wettest president of all time, and guest appearances by Jefferson Airplane and the Black Panthers. Clip two.
If Woodstock was in an office building and filled with wheelchairs and medical supplies, this is Woodstock. And all these people are finding a community that they hadn't had in person until now.
I want that for all of us. Point four. This episode should probably be called Direct Action. And okay, I'll mention it. I'm recording this submission in the middle of a horrendously mismanaged global pandemic, and I have been very inspired to see people coming together in mutual aid and direct action, and the ability of people to organize and make a point in public seems like our only way to get out of gestures broadly at the entire world. I love that this episode shows how hard these people fought for these victories that, although they're small steps toward a larger goal, have brought some little bit of justice to people. Clip three.
Cheers.
Cheers.
To everybody.
To literally everybody.
For all these reasons, I think Drunk History, Season 5, Episode 5, Civil Rights, deserves a place in the canon, and I hope you agree. Thanks.
Thank you, Eleanor. Sarah, I know this is a fave show of yours. Why don't you start?
It really is. This is, I'd seen this episode a couple of times before, and I remember it making me cry the first time, and it made me cry again. At the end, like, there's just this moment where this sit-in that they've been doing for almost a month in a office building in San Francisco ends, and all of these actors are sort of pouring out of the front door of this office building, and it was like... and the, especially in that part of, that segment of the episode, that kind of pointed up in a touching way versus hilarious, what is, I think, my favorite thing about the show generally, which is that on some things, the attention to detail is like, whatever, like I think wigs are not on the correct direction. And it's like, but they don't care about that. They know that it's like the little early Simpsons-y throwaway jokes, like when some narrator is talking about the fucking president, and then on JFK's desk, it doesn't say Kennedy, it says the fucking president, but with little asterisks changing it. Or like when they're burping in the middle of a narration and like a guy playing Bull Connor has to be like, excuse me. Just it's the little things like the Americans with Disabilities Act with all the ums and uhs of the narrator in it. And that they extended that detail to casting differently abled actors as well, to, you know, making sure that a heartfelt moment stayed in as well as like belching and people saying that they're too drunk to be doing this. I think sets this apart a little bit from other episodes. Also that there's a slow-mo fight scene with like Waka Waka guitar, which Eleanor is right. This was completely metal. I watched that scene twice. It is great. This was enjoyable to revisit, even though I remember seeing the episode title and being like, oh, I feel like this was kind of a tough one. And it kind of is, but it's, you know, the point is well taken that this is a show that's an extended bit, but it knows, it has such a good ear for itself by this point in its own run that it's able to do something a little more serious without being like a Jon Stewart-y about it, for lack of a better shorthand.
Yeah. No, I think that's the perfect shorthand.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, just like a ton of swearing and people losing track of themselves and excellent actors just like doing these, I mean, this lip syncing. It really is a good bit, is the thing. Like, it's a fucking good bit. So interesting choice and excellent presentation. And I'm interested to hear what Tara and Dave had to say. Tara.
I agree with Eleanor that the last story about the 504 sit-in is the high point of the episode. And I also choked up the first time and this time at To Everybody. I had forgotten that Ali Stroker is who's playing Judy Heumann, who I saw in, not Judy Heumann, I saw Ali Stroker in Oklahoma a couple of years ago on Broadway, and she's tremendous. It would have been a less effective telling of the story if it hadn't been disabled actors playing the disabled characters at the heart of it.
P.S. I don't know what Zach Anner is up to, but everyone hire him. Charisma and an amazing handlebar mustache as well.
Yeah. But I don't know about this I mean, I was really looking forward to the presentation. I think she did a great job, but I'm not 100% convinced that other than the 504, that this episode is any more special than like the, you know, what we always say when a show is like kind of consistently good.
Yeah.
It's just always good. Like, I don't know that this one necessarily rises to the next level for me personally. And I'm also just going to say, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I don't think any of these three narrators is sufficiently drunk. They seem very... Yeah. Clear-headed to me, mostly.
Let me rephrase that, because this is my argument. I think this episode pulls its punches. Mm. I feel like the better episode would have been one where they got him even drunker and actually got, like, true emotive moments from them rather than... Because, you know, you can tell that they have a story that's prepared beforehand, and they sort of, like, half-riffed on prepared material, and then... You know, as they get progressively drunker, you know, weird shit slips in. That didn't really happen in this episode because they don't really seem to be drinking that much. And I feel like there was a hesitancy in this episode because the material was so heavy and sometimes dark that they didn't want to get them too drunk. But I think that would have been the way better episode to have a successful I am drunk and I don't know, I'm super sad or I'm super mad about what happened or whatever.
Yeah.
And have that on the screen rather than what I think they did, which is play safe.
Yeah.
I felt like Crystal was on the verge of vomiting. I actually expected a planter to be used for that purpose. But I see your point. It's, I mean, the line between the drunk and the history part, like, it's a knife edge, and it's possible they didn't stay up on it. I think that's a good thing for this episode, but your mileage, of course, may vary.
I think the level of difficulty on making an episode that works with the subject matter goes up if they are drunk, truly drunk, which I don't think they were. But I'm saying that would have been what catapults this into what I would consider like the upper echelon.
The canon of, sphere.
Of the canon sphere for this show, which is, you know, has a formula and sticks to it well for the most part. Mm. I feel like this is just sort of like a lost opportunity episode for me.
I have nothing to add. I think you just picked up where I left off pretty much. So,
all right. So I think I know where this is going, but let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting?
I'm going to vote yes.
Tara Ariana?
A very respectful no, but thank you for Elner. That was very well presented. And an episode that makes you want to beat up cops is, of course, never unwelcome.
Any episode of any show, but sure.
Mm-hmm.
This episode is fine. I just don't think it elevates itself to canon status. So that means Drunk History, Season 5, Episode 5, Civil Rights. You are hereby not inducted into the extra Hot Creek canon.
It's going to be a 26-day sit-in now. Great job, guys.
Love a winner.
Yup.
and will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, it's kind of winner with an asterisk because it's sort of like winning by abandoning a losing strategy. But basically, I have complained on this podcast before about the FX on Hulu bullshit that they've been pulling. And the news is they're not doing it anymore. They are just going to be, as Deadline puts it, a singular brand across linear and streaming Disney platforms globally. So starting this month, FX on Hulu branding will be phased out, with FX programming, which includes exclusive originals and next day shows, will be curated in an FX hub on the streamer. I don't understand. yes, it does sort of unmuddy the waters if it's not FX on Hulu, but it's like, if some of this is FX content that doesn't air on FX, the TV network called FX, then how
then
is this
Hulu
not just
content.
Hulu, right? And, you know, the other problem with this is that if you're saying that, like, we're one brand across all platforms or whatever, it doesn't solve the problem of when people go looking for American Crime Story Impeachment on Hulu because that's where they know FX shows go, and it's not there. It's like you still have a branding problem anyway. I'm glad it's not FX on Hulu anymore because that was dumb. But this doesn't seem a huge amount less dumb, but I will just still take it as a victory or my complaining.
There should be a podcast that we put out called A Huge Amount Less Dumb. I don't know why I feel like that's a great title. Sarah, who is this week's loser?
Oh, boy. By the time you even hear this, he will probably have quit five other things, including his own carpool. But CNN's suspension of Chris Cuomo became a termination effective immediately because apparently it wasn't just that he was a, quote, journalist who was trying to Bigfoot other journalists, including he denied doing it to Ronan Farrow, but only because Ronan Farrow wouldn't have had it anyway. That's not why CNN decided to fire Chris Cuomo completely. Apparently, a sexual harassment allegation was made against him. And CNN was like, yeah, no. Bye. And then he announced earlier today that he's stepping back from his SiriusXM show. What a shame.
Yeah, he'll really be missed.
Speaking Ooh. About saying, yeah, no. Do you know what time it is?
Game time.
It's Good non-regulation time. Game time, I assume.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Game Time. This is the fourth game time of the season. It is not a non-regulation game. It is a regulation game because as soon as we heard that our guest, Brandy, couldn't make it, I was on my phone, and I got Mr. Taylor Cole to come in and play for Valley Guest. Welcome, Taylor.
Welcome back, Taylor.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
So, our scores are Tara with 2, Sarah with 1, Valley Guest still looking to get on the board. Today, we are playing Do You Know What Not Ready for Prime Time It Is? From Greg and the Gang at EHG Assist.
Nice, guys.
Of course, Greg earns himself an extra credit topic. In today's game, I will tell you the guest and musical act of an episode of Saturday Night Live. You tell me the year it was from.
Oh, boy. Okay. Wow, okay.
Okay, but there's some rules here.
Okay.
It's not as bad as it seems at first blush. You get a free guess with just that information right off the bat. If you don't guess the exact year, I will then give you a notable skit or moment from that episode, and you can guess again.
Okay.
Bullseye guesses on your first guess, 5 whopping points.
Dang.
Ooh.
Bullseye guesses on your second guess, 3 points. Within 1 year off, 2 points, 2 years off, 1 point on either side of closest to the pin. It's not Price is the Right rules.
Okay. Gotcha.
Excellent.
Let's throw it to the steel meal situation person, and that is Tara. Hi, Tara.
Hi. Sarah D. Bunting has 3 steel meals. I have 10 steel meals. The valued guests have 4 steel meals plus Eric's meal. And Dave has 4 steel meals to distribute, which he has not done.
All right. So yet. Everybody has lots of steel meals on which to steal today if they so wish.
Yeah.
Let's throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, Sarah, Tara, Taylor, are we ready to play? Do you know what not ready for prime time it is?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Sarah D. Bunting, your guest and musical guest, Malcolm Jamal Warner and Run DMC. You get one guest of the year. You don't have to worry about clues at this point. You just get a free guess.
Okay.
What year do you think that is?
1984.
That is incorrect. This episode featured The Crosby Show with Malcolm Jamal Warner in a family of famous Crosbys. Bing, David, etc.
Sure.
So with that information, you get a second guess.
1985.
1985 is incorrect, but it is 1 year off, so it is worth 2 points.
Nice!
I'll take it.
It is 1986. Okay. Tara.
Yes.
Tim Robbins, Sinead O'Connor.
1989.
Notable skit featured Dana Carvey as Ross Perot.
1992
is correct. That is worth 3 points. Ooh. Taylor, John Heder, Ashley Simpson.
Well, I've got two guesses, so I'm just going to say 2005.
Boom!
Hey!
Yeah, first bullseye, 5 points. He's in the lead.
Taylor knows music years, so he's going to be really good at this game.
Back to Sarah, Michael Phelps and Lil Wayne.
Little Wayne.
It's two teams.
Yes. Hi, I'm Dave.
Of the Kennebunkport Waynes. Ew.
Little Wayneyard. Yes.
Little Wayne. Of Wayneshire. I'm sorry, who was the actual guest again?
I don't remember. Michael Phelps.
Michael Phelps.
Yes.
Oh, when was Phelpsy? 2012?
This episode featured a nonpartisan message from Governor Sarah Palin and Senator Hillary Clinton.
2008.
Yes, 2008. That is worth 3 points. To Tara.
Yep.
Ronda Rousey and Selena Gomez.
Oh, God. Like 2015? Okay.
Features Screen Guild Awards sketch where only white actors in black films are nominated.
God, 2016?
Yes, 2016 is correct. Nice. 3 points. To Taylor. Elon Musk and Miley Cyrus.
I feel like that was this year or last year. I have been away from SNL for several years now, and I'm mentally healthier for it.
Yeah.
Smart.
But I think I'm going to say 2020.
This episode featured first post-quarantine dinner.
2021.
2021 is correct. All right, that ends the... At EHG, self-assessed difficulty, level one is now over. We're now moving into level two.
Okay.
I can't vouch for how I'm really bad at that. I was so bad at this game. So I just left it at is. I didn't reevaluate any of the difficulties. So if anybody out there has a problem, wants to say, wasn't that tough, take it up with at EHG assist.
Here, please address your comments to the ombudsman, Little Wayne of Shropshire.
We gotta find a job here for Little Wayne of Shropshire. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, Desi Arnaz, with musical guests Desi Arnaz and Desi Arnaz Jr.
Is this real?
Yes, this is real. I also was like, really?
Oh gosh. Okay. 1975.
That's what I would have said.
This episode features the skit Gerald Ford's Shrink.
1976.
Yes, 1976. Nice. 3 points. Nice done. Tara.
Yep.
O.J. Simpson and Ashford and Simpson.
Oh, boy.
Oh, come on, guys.
1981.
Featuring Samurai Night Fever.
1978.
Yes, 1978 is Ooh. Correct. To Taylor, Wayne Gretzky, and Fine Young Cannibals.
1988.
What I would have said.
This skit features Wayne Gretzky's visit to Wayne's World.
1987?
You went the wrong way. 1989, but you still get 1 point because you're just 2 years off. Back to Sarah. Joe Pesci and the Spin Doctors.
Wow.
Be a great name for a band in and of itself.
Yep.
Oh my gosh. Chris Barron is a fun follow on Twitter, by the way. 94.
Featuring the skit Debate Between George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot.
92,
yes. Good hint there. 3 points. Tara. Sarah Jessica Parker and R.E.M.
1999.
That's what I would have guessed.
Bill Murray delivers a eulogy for Michael O'Donoghue.
Oh my God.
Fuck.
I thought that guy died in the 70s. She definitely wasn't hosting it then. Christ. 2000?
No points for that one. Way off the mark. 1994.
What the hell was she on for in 94? LA Story, maybe.
Yeah,
Ed Wood was that year as well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
I always forget
right.
She's in that.
All right, Taylor. Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger are the co-guests with UB... Huh?
That's a good hint.
With UB40 as your musical guest.
I'm sure they're in something together, but I can't think of what it is. I'm going to say 1989.
This episode features the skit Adam Sandler's canteen boy fending off advances from a Boy Scoutmaster.
1990?
You're outside the point range. That is 1994 again. Also,
oh, Jesus.
Sarah. Okay, great combo. Tom Arnold with musical guest Tupac Shakur.
Wow.
Okay, well, we have an end date then, I guess.
Could have been his hologram.
True. 93.
Featuring presidential debate. You're getting the presidential debate. Between Lamar Alexander, Pat Buchanan, Bob Dole, and more.
Lamar. I think that was 92.
96?
96.
Wow. I never thought Tom Arnold was still a going concern that late.
No, me neither.
I believe The Stupids came out that year. Was probably what he was promoting.
Sure.
Oh, boy. Tara, Rob Lowe and the Spice Girls.
1998.
Featuring the skit Goth Talk.
97?
Yes, 97. Good for three.
Nice. Well done.
To Taylor. Not for any extra points, but I'm going to have you guess the musical guest. Your guest is Garth Brooks. Who do you think the musical guest was?
Chris Gaines.
Chris Gaines is correct. Yes.
Love it. Fair point for that.
So what year is that?
So Garth Brooks and Chris Gaines. Wow. 1990.
Featuring Will Ferrell as NRA President Charlton Heston.
1998?
Not correct, but you're 1 year off, so you get 2 points. That's 1999.
All right.
Sarah D. Bunting, Lance Armstrong, and Sheryl Crow.
Another time capsule.
Jeez.
Yeah, I'll say. Shit. 2001.
Featuring a message from the Vice President Dick Cheney.
2003.
You get 1 point. That is 2005. All right, this is question 17.
It's pretty cool.
It's
for Tara.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Rudd and One Direction.
Oh, shit. Well, he just hosted this year, but that wouldn't be One Direction. 2014.
Featuring the skit The Sound of Music Live and Condensed.
What did I say, 2014?
Yep.
2013.
Yes, 2013 is correct.
Ooh.
Nice.
All right, this is for Taylor. We'll take us into our score break. It's the last of the level twos. Chadwick Boseman and
Carly Rae Jepsen?
No.
Cardi B?
Cardi B.
Yeah. The Cicello. 2018
is my guess.
2018 is correct. Five points. Yes. Wow. Nicely done. All right. That is pretty kind of halfway through-ish. Let's hear the scores.
It's a quite close game. Taylor is, as expected, not to jinx you, in the lead with 16 points. I have 15. Sarah has 12.
All right. Let's get back to it with Sarah. This is now level 3 of 5 levels of difficulty.
Oh, God.
Candace Bergen.
Yes.
Esther Phillips.
Eighty-eight
is incorrect. Featuring the skit Land Shark. Land Shark.
This is very weird. Land Shark. Okay, I was way off then. 78.
Just out of point range. 75.
Oh.
Tara. Pee-wee Herman and Queen Ida. IDA.
Yeah. 1986.
Featuring the skit, actually featuring the, I believe, pre-filmed Die Foreigner Die parody ad for a Stallone Chuck Norris film where they list all the types of foreigners that they will kill.
1987.
Oh, you went the wrong way, but you still got 2 points. It's 1985. Taylor, we've got guest Linda Hamilton with musical guest Mariah Carey.
Was Mariah Carey that early, 91? Because 91 makes sense for Linda Hamilton, because that's T2. I was just going
to say 1991. Boom. You got another 5. Nice. Look at the big brain on Brad. All right.
Yeah.
Sarah D. Bundy, Reese Witherspoon, and Alicia Keys.
What year was that?
2011.
Featuring Lauren Michaels asking Rudy Giuliani if Saturday Night Live can be funny.
Again.
Yeah.
2002?
Incorrect. Off by 1 year for 2 points. 2001, coming back from 9/11. Tara.
Mm-hmm.
Al Gore and Fish. Fish.
Mm-hmm. 2006.
Featuring Al Gore in The West Wing.
2005.
2002. No points.
Ooh.
Taylor, Kate Winslet, and Eminem.
Okay. 2000.
2000. Incorrect. Featuring the skit Fun with Real Audio.
2004.
Correct.
Hey!
3 points. Sarah, Bryan Cranston, Kanye West.
Kanye West.
I'm just going to lead into it now.
Bryan Cranston, Kanye West.
Yeah, Kanye West.
Kanye West.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. 2015.
Featuring the Miley Cyrus show with Vanessa Bayer as Miley Cyrus.
As Miley Stylus.
Miley Stylus.
2017.
Way off. 2010.
Oh, okay.
Tara.
Yep.
Everybody's favorite Hawkeye, Jeremy Renner, with Maroon 5.
Oh. No, thank you. Times two. Was probably when it was probably for the town. So 2006.
Featuring the skit The Avengers.
Oh, 2008.
Incorrect.
2012.
Oh, is that a steel mill?
Oh. Sure, I got 4.
Okay. You got 5, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, even better.
2012. Yeah, correct.
Nice. Hey.
So that's a 3-point steal. All right, here's your actual question, Taylor. Okay. Melissa McCarthy and Imagine Dragons.
Oh, boy. 2013.
featuring Super Bowl halftime sketch with impressions of Peyton Manning, Michael Strahan, and Howie Long.
Michael Strahan.
Strahan? Yes. Michael Strahan and
Strahan.
Howie. Strahan.
And Michael Long. Strahan. Strahan.
Just for a moment, can everybody just shut the fuck up?
No. That means it's January, which is making me think early, or January, February, Super Bowl time, which is making me think early Sean Spicer days. So I'm going to say 2017.
Incorrect. That is 2014. All right, Sarah DeBunting, we are now at level 4.
No, great.
Steve Martin is your guest with musical acts Paul and Linda McCartney and separately 3D. I don't know who that is. It's just somebody who wasn't involved with the McCartneys also sure. was there. So Steve Martin with the McCartneys and 3D.
76.
Featuring the sketch Real Incredible People, which was a mashup of two shows. Real People and That's Incredible, I would guess.
Yes.
78.
Incorrect, but we are within 2 points of 2 years of 1980, so that is 1 point. Tara.
Yep.
The Rock and Andrew WK.
2010.
Featuring the skit The Scorpion Prince.
Oh boy.
So the most Uncanny Valley-y CG ever.
Yeah. 2006?
No. 2002.
Wow. It's earlier than I thought.
Taylor. Mm-hmm. Take us into our next score break. Lindsay Lohan and Usher.
2004
with confidence. 5 points.
Wow.
I think we're at a mathematical contention, probably, but let's just see what the scores are.
Taylor has 32.
Uh-huh.
I have 17. Uh-huh. Sarah has 15.
Well.
Yeah, if he gets all his wrong and you get all your 5 points, you still won't win.
Yeah, we understand how math works.
Well, you don't know how many questions are left. I'm just saying that it is.
Is this Strahan math?
Well, there's still males in play. YN.
Look, I'm going to give Sarah 1 day point just to show that I can just not get mad at everything I mispronounce.
Sarah's day point has been noted.
Ralph Nader. This is the 5 point level. This is the 5 difficulty zone.
Yes.
Ralph Nader, George Benson. Ralph Nader with George Benson.
All right. 2000.
Featuring the skit, Ralph Nader talks with Jimmy Carter.
You're a little off.
1980.
Just out of point zone. 1977.
Oh, Tara. Okay.
Yep.
Tim Curry and meatloaf in a food-oriented package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Delicious.
They could have put Cayenne West in there and just spice it up some more.
Sure.
1981. Yeah.
5 points. Oh, God. Correct.
Nice.
Taylor. Steve Martin again with Van Morrison.
Boo. Ooh.
Very boo. I feel like given how long both those guys have been messing around in the world, this could be almost any time.
It really could.
I'm going to say 1990.
Featuring the skit Inflation is Our Friend.
1986.
No. Way off on that one. That is 1978. Sarah DeBunting, here is your last question. Tom Hanks with Keith Richards.
Even my dog hates this question. Tom Hanks and Keith Richards?
Yeah.
98.
Featuring the skit Pumping Up with Hans and Franz.
87.
Oh, 2 points. You're 1 year off. 1988.
I only knew that because of the Keith Richards review and the sassy that we just talked about.
Whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tara, here's your last five difficulty. Mm-hmm. Ben Affleck. Yep. Affleck and mm-hmm. Fiona Apple.
1999.
Oh, that's what I would have said.
Featuring the sketch George W. Bush and John McCain on the Weekend Update.
2000.
You are correct. 3 points.
Nice.
And our last question of regulation is for Taylor Cole, who has taken this game, put it in his pocket. He's already halfway down the street. Britney Spears with musical guest Britney Spears.
Oh, okay. 2003.
Featuring Daryl Hammond as Dick Cheney.
Ooh. It's not 99. It could be 2000. No, it's because that's 2000. I'll say 2000.
2000, you went the... Nope, 2002, but you got 1 point for that last one. That is the game. Let's hear the scores. Feels like a blowout.
Correct. Sarah DeBunting has finished with 17 points, the spread eagle of points. I have 25. Taylor Cole running it like nobody's business. 33 big points. Good job, Taylor.
Wow. Impressive.
Nice.
Thank you. Valued guest.
Oh, nicely done. Nicely done. Thank you, Taylor,
Starting
in at the 11th hour.
Thank you for having me. This was a pleasure.
We appreciate it. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We dug up the dirt on HBO's true crime miniseries Landscapers before going around the dial with stops at Annie Live, Money Heist, Baptiste, and Hawkeye. A Sad Toast was made for Eleanor's Drunk History Canis submission, while we crowned winners and losers of the week, and Taylor Cole was the winner of this week's Game Time from Greg and the gang at EHG Assist. Next up is the 12 Shows of Christmas on Extra Extra Hot Great. And right here on EHG Prime next week, you can catch And Just Like That. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
stuck with a day that's gray and lonely,
Sarah D. Bunting,
these titties get to vote now,
and Taylor Cole.
I definitely listened to Usher on the way to see Mean Girls in the theater in 2004.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
I'll see you in 10 minutes. I'm getting a fucking sandwich.